Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a drug policy conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Drug policy, as in the framework and regulation towards drugs of abuse. On April 3rd, 2025, the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, ONDCP, released administration's focus on six key areas in its first year. Number one, reduce the number of overdose fatalities with a focus on fentanyl. Two, secure the global supply chain against drug trafficking. Three, stop the flow of drugs across the border. Four, prevent drug use before it starts. Five, provide treatment that leads to long-term recovery. And six, innovate in research and data to support drug control strategies. These action items direct drug policy and funding for this Trump administration. All agencies should be theoretically aligned in these goals. To learn more about drug policy, I reached out to Judge Linda Davis. Judge Linda Davis is an award-winning judge and community leader who serves as the executive director of Face Addiction Now. Face Addiction Now is a nonprofit that connects individuals impacted by substance use with no-cost programs and resources with the goal of lasting recovery. Judge Davis received numerous awards for her addiction treatment work from organizations such as the FBI, Girl Scouts of America, and the Michigan Association of Treatment Court Professionals. She was on Michigan Governor Rick Snyder's Opioid Task Force, chaired the Governor's Commission for the Prescription Overdose and Opioid Response Team, was invited to consult with President Trump's Opioid Task Force and First Lady Melania Trump's Roundtable on Opioids' Impact on Families. She is now a voting member of the Opioid Advisory Commission in Michigan, which will determine how funds from the National Opioid Settlement will be spent in the state. To learn more about Judge Linda Davis, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Judge Davis on April 18th, 2025. Judge Linda Davis, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is exciting. I don't know if we've had a judge on the show before, but tell us, what does it take to become a judge?
A lot of education. And then there's multiple ways, multiple routes you can go. You can run in a general election, or you can be appointed by the governor if there is a vacancy. I was actually appointed by our governor. And so a judge was removed from office for some wrongdoing in Michigan. And I was picked to take his spot and felt very blessed to be in that position. So I served for 19 years as a district court judge. And district courts are different in every state, too. In Michigan, that's what's considered people's court. So you get a real opportunity to make change in people's life. It's not so much about the punishment, but more about helping them get back on the right track and restore their lives to some kind of normalcy.
Nice. So you're in Michigan, right?
I am.
Is the drug crisis different in Michigan, or is it, you know, like most other areas in the United States?
Well, I would say that we're probably hit a little bit harder than most areas because we have multiple freeways that run through our state. And so those are usually used as pipelines for transporting drugs. So we get a lot of drugs coming into the state. We were really hit very hard with the opioid crisis. We have a lot of large cities that were really affected by that, but it is filtered into rural areas. So I would say that we're the same in a lot of ways, probably close to what California is experiencing. But there are states that have not been quite as hard, hit as hard as Michigan has.
Yeah. And it's interesting because you're closer to the northern border. I'm in San Diego, closer to the southern border. Are you seeing that drug trafficking from Canada?
I don't see that personally myself, but it's talked a lot about it. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of social media around it where drugs are coming over from Canada. So I think we get our share of that. Yeah. But to be honest with you, I think most of it's filtering north from Mexico. I think they plan their cartels very well and targeted pockets and have that pretty much dispersed across the United States. And so I think we've seen a lot of drugs coming through Mexico as well. And then across, I mean, drugs are so available through social media now as well. So I think it's a combination of things that are happening.
Yeah. I thought it'd be fun to take a little history through drug policy, because you mentioned the opioid crisis, and that's I like to make the distinction that that was opioid prescriptions. Now fentanyl is still an opioid, but it's a different crisis because we really we ended the opioid prescription crisis. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's a lot. It's not an epidemic or a crisis anymore. But I came into this whole issue because of the opioid prescription. I was on the supply chain, right, as a physician. And, you know, people would come in, like we called it, Candyland, to get their drugs. And I think that that's where you started as well.
It is. I was seeing the perfect storm kind of happen in Michigan. I was a drug court judge. And so we were seeing an awful lot of young people, athletes that had sports injuries or young people with wisdom tooths being removed that were prescribed opiate drugs, and as a result ended up with very serious addiction problems, turned to heroin when they no longer could get the prescriptions. And so that was a real issue we were seeing. We had a couple of deaths at the high school that my daughter attended, two 17-year-old boys that died, both that were athletic, good students, died about a month apart from an overdose to heroin, which we had never seen in our community before. And then at the same time, my daughter had a knee injury that she had surgery for the year before her senior year. Unbeknownst to me, she became addicted to Vicodin, ended up on heroin. And so I had my own personal story with battling addiction and the brokenness of the system, and really seeing firsthand what people with substance use problems go through.
Yeah, I remember those days vividly. We would be, you know, the medical community. You said your daughter had a knee injury. I don't know if you remember how many pills she got, but she could have gotten 100, 300 pills. Yeah. I actually did a study by specialty of how many pills you get. Like the emergency department would average 30. You know, a general surgery would average 100, but the orthopedic surgeons, they were the highest at like 300.
Yeah, she got 120 with three refills for a knee surgery.
Yeah, a crazy amount. We fixed that. Thankfully. And how can I ask how she's doing now?
She's great. She entered treatment. It was a rough battle for about 3 years. But she has been opiate free since then. So she now has two beautiful children and another one on the way, and is doing really well in her life. Found the right combination that worked for her, but it was a struggle getting there.
Grandma Judge.
Right. You got it.
That's me. Awesome. That's awesome. And did she do it? I imagine this was years ago. She had to stop opiates, you know, cold turkey, or did she get Suboxone, which is like standard of care these days?
Well, she got Suboxone for a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. That was back when the thinking was you just use it to wean them off of the drugs and then go cold turkey after that. So she was in and out of 7 different treatment facilities. We spent a fortune. But she actually found her recovery in Florida at a 3/4 house and just happened to connect with the right girls. They were going to lots of meetings together. I think she was seeing things like she said, one of the most influential things was seeing women in their 50s that were at this three-quarter house and thinking, my God, I don't want to be 50 battling this. And just really did a lot of hard work, got into a lot of counseling, that kind of thing, and found kind of orchestrated her own recovery. But she did battle with alcohol later on, because a lot of young people, when they get off of the heavier drugs, they think they can still normalize things and have a good time with friends by drinking. She found out she could not do that either. And she used Vivitrol, which is a once a month shot, to help with the cravings for alcohol, but has been free of that for over 6 years now as well.
Yeah. It takes a long time to reprogram.
It sure does.
Right?
It sure does.
I always like to ask patients, and like, when did you first start using drug, any drug? And it's like 13, 15 years old. And now they're older. And it's like, well, it's not, your brain won't reorganize in 2 weeks. You've been doing this for 10 years. Give it at least a year. And then, you know.
Yeah. They say that the average brain takes about 2 years to completely heal from drug use. Yeah. And I can tell you, I work with thousands and thousands of people that are going through the recovery process. And I would say that 2 year mark is instrumental in determining what they're going to do with their future. So
you saw a lot of people with addiction as a judge. And tell us a little bit about what that's like. Like, how do you judge people? Like, how do you know, okay, this one I'm going to give a second chance to, and this one needs to go to jail, or how, well, is it just a feeling, or is there criteria?
Yeah, I as a drug court judge, and my feelings about drug use obviously have changed with the more education I got. It's really a shame that so many of the careers that are centered around drug use and addiction, alcohol addiction, those kind of things, really there is no education that ever teaches you about addiction. I was a drug court judge, so I got a little bit of education with that. I think we're doing a better job of it now, but we're making everyday decisions on what happens with a person's life with really very little education about this disease, how it works, what works as far as a treatment modality for it. And so I think judges were incarcerating people with drug problems just because they didn't know any better, just like police officers arrest people with drug problems because there were no alternatives for them. I think we're moving in a direction where we're providing lots of alternatives. We have in Michigan one of the largest amounts of drug courts per capita of any other state in the union, which really are treatment courts, looking to help people rather than to punish them. But gut level, I mean, jail works for some people. You know, I always say that I'm open to all pathways of recovery, and that does include incarceration, if that's what really is going to get somebody's attention and make them want to change their life. Not that this is a choice, but certainly there has to be consequences to that behavior, because using drugs feels good. And so it has to be when the consequences are greater than the good feelings that you're getting that I think you become more adaptable to treatment modalities that are out there. For some people, it's sitting in jail and just realizing this isn't what I want my life to be. They come out and then they have a lot of really hard work to do to get back on that right track. So a lot of it has to do with the education, not so much gut level. But when you're working in a drug court situation, gut level comes into it when you've tried everything else and nothing is working. So it's a combination of things.
Yeah. And definitely people said that they being in jail has saved their lives, right? And it depends. And you need to have deterrence. Right. Because like you said very well, it feels good. So, but you have to have deterrence. We don't want you to do this.
I will say that for a lot of parents, going to jail for someone that's using drugs is respite care for them. You know, that is
parents
the only
beg,
time that
beg,
they're not
please
worried
keep
about
them,
their
keep...
loved one. Right.
Right. Now I see that because we have parents, begging to keep them on a psychiatric hold because they're afraid they're going to die.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
The same kind of principle.
Yeah. There's a whole lot of fear wrapped around families that are dealing with addiction, because every time the phone rings, you're afraid it's going to be that call.
Yeah.
And when they're in jail, there's that sense of security that they're safer there, you know, so that's really sad, but it's true. And a lot of parents have told me that that was kind of like when you're taking care of a senior and they have homes you can take them to for a week so you can get a break from that. It's kind of respite care for people that are dealing with a loved one with addiction.
Yeah. And it's an opportunity to be drug-free and try to get your brain a little back to think.
Right, right.
That's interesting. Any cases stand out in your time in drug court?
Yes, there was a young girl. I really, when I first started drug court, I didn't have a lot of education around addiction. And so I was kind of feeling my way through this. And I had heard that, you know, the more involved the judge is, the better chance your outcomes are with individuals, because judges give people lots of accolades. And it's really important to do that, that a lot of people that use drugs, there's a lot of self-loathing that goes on as a result of it. They don't really feel like they're worthy of care. And so when a judge who's a person of authority shows that kind of care for an individual, it really helps them get motivated to do the hard work. So early on in my drug court career, I really didn't think my words would make much difference to anybody. But I had read a book called Moments of Clarity. And that book really changed my opinion on how we approach people with drug use. It was a book about a number of people. Some were senators, some were movie stars, some were athletes who had literally lost everything because of their drug use, were living on the street. And they were interviewing them, asking, what made you eventually find your path to recovery? And it was like they were saying things like, you know, I watched friends die, that didn't do it. I lost my job, that didn't do it. I lost my family, that didn't do it. But it was when one person who I didn't even know saw in me something that I forgotten existed, and it gave me hope that maybe I could get back there again and be that person again. So that always like really impressed me, that my words really matter to people, and that how I approach this might be the difference in whether they're willing to give this a chance or not. So I had a young girl, she was 17, in Michigan, 17, you're in adult court at that point. She had a long history, family history of drug use. Both her mother and father were heroin users. And she was raised in that environment. The first time she ever used heroin was actually with her parents. This young girl, she must have weighed 86 pounds soaking wet. Her hair was literally matted to her head. She hadn't bathed in ages. She was a mess. And I thought, how in the world am I ever going to influence this girl? She has no support at home. But I just started talking to her, and she was telling me all about her drug use. And I said, let's just hold off on that for a little bit. I know you're here because of your drug use, but I want to know more about you. Before, I know you started using drugs at 10, so that might be hard for you to think back. It was 17 years ago, but before you started using drugs, what were your hopes? And she said, I wanted to be an artist. And I said, were you good? And she says, I think for a 10-year-old, I was pretty good. And I said, oh, well, what kind of art did you like doing? And she said, I love Disney, and I used to do a lot of drawing of Disney characters. And I think when I think back to that, what I would have really loved to have done is to have been an artist and work for Disney. And I said, wow, that's amazing. I said, well, the next time I see you, I want you to draw some things and bring them to me. And she said, you're going to let me into drug court? And I said, yeah, I'm going to let you into drug court. And I said, so bring me some of your artwork. So the first time I saw her, she did. And she was good. I mean, she was really very talented. And I said, well, listen, I'm going to make you a deal. And she said, what? I said, I want you to really work hard in drug court. And if you're really making some good progress, 90 days from now, we have a victim advocates room that we use to interview children that have been sexually abused. It's just a very cold looking room. And I really would love to have it painted with Disney characters. So I'll buy the paint and let you paint that room. And she just lit up like a light bulb every time she came to drug court, which was once a week. She would bring me pictures that she drew, and she started drawing what her vision for this room would look like. And I was really impressed with it. Well, on the 90th day, it was not a drug court day, but she showed up in my courtroom and she said, Judge, it's 90 days today. And I said, I know it is. And she said, I haven't had one single violation. I've gone to all my counseling. I've gone to all my meetings. I'm doing everything you asked me to do. can I paint that room? And I said, yep, I have the supplies in my office. I took her down. She painted the room. It remains that way today. Make a long story short, she graduated after 18 months of being in drug court. She never had a single violation, never tested positive once. We got her into some stable housing. She was just doing great with her life. She went on, she graduated from drug court. And 2 years after she graduated, my drug court team received a letter from her. And she indicated to us that she was still sober at that point, was doing very well and wanted to thank us. And she wanted to let us know that she had a job working for Disney and was traveling the world as an artist for Disney. So that is my go-to story all the time, because to me, she was someone that I thought was hopeless and helpless. And it would take a miracle to get her on the right road because of her lack of support, how many years she had been using, how young she had started. And it really showed me that if the right kind of care is given to individuals and the right attitude comes along with it, that almost everybody can be helped. Now, it's a disease. It's like cancer. Some people work really hard to find recovery and they never do, and they die of their addiction. Just like cancer, some people work really hard. They do chemo, they do surgery, they do radiation. And unfortunately, we can't control all diseases, and there is a percentage that we're not going to see make it. But I like to focus on the odds that most people can be helped, and that we have to give it our all for every individual that crosses our path.
Yeah. And we have 20 million Americans living in recovery, proving.
Yes.
That's the case.
Yes. That recovery can happen.
What a beautiful, beautiful story. And I'm really touched by how you were able to find what motivated her.
Yeah. You have to listen. You have to listen. You know, it's a.
But you asked the right questions.
Yes.
Also.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. That's very inspiring. Going down, you know, we were just saying we're going to take a history. So that comes the history of opioid prescriptions and then heroin. And today it's fentanyl that is worse than anything we've ever had in the history of the world, and killing people with addiction and without addiction. I was going to get your opinions on the current crisis.
Yeah. I just think that we're always. I think we live in a world where there's so much negativity anymore, and there's so much pressure on kids that young people and older people are always going to be seeking something that makes them feel better. I mean, we live in a pill-popping society. We may have prescription drugs under control, the opioid crisis a little bit, but we still write an awful lot of prescriptions. It scares me, the number of young people that are on Adderall and HDA medication. And we take pills to go to sleep. We take pills to wake up. We take pills to alter our moods. You know, we even go so far as when God is telling us we're no longer sexually active, we take pills to make us sexually active. We just pop pills for everything. And kids are being raised that we don't want people to feel anything negative or go through bad times. And I think that's what got us into the whole opiate crisis, is we don't ever want to feel. And so we just try to numb ourselves from everything. So I think that the fentanyl crisis is indicative of that. If we stop opiates, it's going to be something else. When we stop fentanyl, it will be something else that's mind altering. Just because of the world and the way it's become, unfortunately. I think of social media. I think we've always had sadness in the world, but I think it's so in your face right now for young people that social media, as wonderful as it can be, and it connects the world at all corners, we're using it right now. It can also be very damaging for young people who don't have the maturity to process things they're hearing.
Yeah. And that the social media aspect, I know, is a goal for the administration. But right. You're right. And then if we want to prevent it, then you're right. We are a pill popping society for everything, and just walk into a grocery store,
right?
You know, all the different brands that you can have. But also, life is hard, And we need to teach at a young age how to deal with adversities without drugs, right? I tell the story of my, I went into my granddaughter's, you know, 2-year-old birthday class, you know, went to that, and there's a little sign on the wall. Right? If you're frustrated, you know, take a breath or sit down, you know, at 2 years old, you know, there are little skills that they teach you what to do when you're frustrated, right?
Right.
And that needs to continue to develop those good patterns.
Right. And we also need to teach kids, I think, how to fail. You know, everybody gets a trophy now when you play a sport. It's never done on merit anymore. Everything is done to make people feel good. And I think we need to go back. That kids need to learn you're not going to be good at everything you try, and you don't get rewarded when you're not good at that. You find something else that you're good at.
Right.
You know? And
or keep trying or whatever. What, you know, like.
Right. Right.
And like go back to.
Yeah,
just probably like the example that you said with the girl with the Disney characters. She had a skill, but I bet you she had to work on it before she got to work to Disney.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Not everything comes easy in life, and you're going to have ups and downs, and you're going to feel like you don't matter sometimes. But we need to teach kids how to deal with those things. And I think we've really gotten far away from that.
Yeah, that is a very good point. The Trump administration has, I don't know if you saw them, that an action items for drug policy. The focus over the next year is to reduce the number of overdose fatalities, secure the global supply chain, to stop the flow of drugs across the borders, to prevent drug use before it starts, what we just talked about, treatment that leads to long-term recovery, and innovations in research. What do you think that kind of is a good target?
Yeah, I do. You know, I think we're right on target with that. I think that we need to put the same effort into addiction that we did in solving, you know, the COVID crisis that we experienced. When you stop to think about how little money is spent and the number of people that are suffering and dying from addiction, it's really kind of heartbreaking to me. You know, I work in this space every day, and for as many successes as we have, we still have people that are dying from this. And we need to give that person the same kind of thought that we did when COVID hit. Like, it amazed me the action steps we took to serve people that had COVID. We need to do the same thing around this drug crisis and really be innovative for it and put the money into it.
Right.
I always say that, you know, we get this backwards. We put so much money into, not that these things aren't important, into homelessness, food insecurities, the foster care system. But if we realize that at the root of most of those cases are some kind of an addiction problem, that we could really solve so many of the world's problems if we would just deal with this root cause of how do we educate people? How do we provide prevention things for young people so that they don't ever get to this spot in their life? And then if they do, have really intentional treatment modalities that are dealing with individuals where they're at and walking them through this process.
Yeah, that is critical. I was laughing when you said COVID because I was on the front lines of COVID with the little astronaut suit and everything, you know, working on that. And yet every day and every diagnosis was COVID, COVID, COVID. And I was saying fentanyl, fentanyl, fentanyl. Right. I mean,
right.
The first intubation I think I did with the whole PAPR thing and you can't hear when we all thought, oh, it's COVID, you know, and it wasn't. It was an overdose. And I think that what we could do better as a system is treat drugs like infectious disease. What if this was malaria? What if it was COVID? You would deal with the supply, right? Prevent it, you know, drain the swamps from malaria, you know, whatever, you know, contain the whatever source was bringing the COVID virus, to contain it. You know, do prevention and then, you know, and then offer treatment. But, you know, there is a solution and you could track it and map it, these overdoses, just like we would for COVID or influenza. I remember being really jealous of, you know, we'd have a Shigella diarrhea outbreak, and we're, you know, opening up hotel rooms and we're doing all these things, right, and sending memos. And it's like, why aren't we doing that for drugs?
Absolutely. And I think one of the differences that people don't have a preconceived stigma about a lot of the diseases that you're talking about. Like, nobody thought, oh, people that get COVID are bad people. But you're dealing with the stigma around addiction, and there's a lot of judgment around it. I think that's why the money has not been put toward it in the past.
And I think it's a philosophy. Yeah. It's like, well, drugs are here, like mental health or drugs. Mm-hmm. And infections are here,
right.
And instead of thinking of them as we would any chronic disease,
absolutely,
right? Like the administration, Bobby Kennedy's talking about the chronic disease epidemic. This is part of it.
Yeah, it truly is. You know, and I'm hopeful that we're moving in that direction. I think there's more talk around this being a disease and not a moral failing, and. As unfortunate as the opiate crisis was, I think it hit enough families that didn't understand addiction and never had dealt with addiction in their families. It really opened their eyes to this can happen to anybody. Mm-hmm. And when it affects you personally, I mean, I certainly changed my attitude after I had a personal bout with this in my family. I had never dealt with addiction in my family. So this was really an unusual occurrence for us. But it really helped me educate myself and change my attitudes around it. And now I think I'm a huge voice of change in Michigan. And we're dealing with so many groups, like the organization that I helped start, Face Addiction Now, that we started 17 years ago. And I had the pleasure of working with the Trump administration his first term, and was really excited about what was happening around this and have continued that work. But I really think that we're starting to move toward looking at this more as a disease and coming up with solutions that are innovative. But I also think that we have to include lots of groups like police officers. Our group works with 180 police departments in the state of Michigan and 60 in the state of New York to come up with alternatives to incarceration for people that get arrested for drug use problems. Our largest signature program is a program called Hope Not Handcuffed, where you can literally walk into any one of the 185 police departments. They're not going to arrest you. Just ask for help. They call us and we start that process for you. So we have placed literally tens of thousands of people into treatment through that one program. And then we are educating police officers on how they can do their jobs differently and be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And it's really been eye-opening. We hear so much negative about law enforcement, but it really is that we just don't educate them and provide them with the tools to be able to do this. We're asking them to take on a social work skill without having social work background. And so our group has really educated police officers about addiction. We constantly engage with them, and it's really amazing to see how willing they are to help people when they really understand the problem. And so we've really started a movement here in Michigan, and we get invited all over the United States to train police officers to do what our officers are doing here in the state of Michigan.
Yeah, interesting. I love that. Hope Not Handcuffs. And did I hear correctly that people actually walk in to a law enforcement agency for medical help and addiction?
Yes. It was really interesting because when we first started that program, we patterned it out of a program that we saw a police chief start in Gloucester, Massachusetts, called the PARI program. And it was a very small rural area that he did it in. And I always have great big visions. And so I thought we could do that in our community. And so we have 23 law enforcement agencies in the area that I live in, the county that I live in. And I had an in with them because I was a prosecutor and a judge. And so I started meeting with them and talking about the program. And at first there was no interest at all. But as we began talking to them, I convinced four of them to do a pilot program. By the time we actually launched it, we had all 23 police departments on board to do it. This was pre-COVID. That program got, in the first month, we had 300 people that walked into the police departments asking for help. But there was a promise that they were not going to be arrested. All they did was ask their first name. They placed a phone call to us. We would send either a peer coach or a volunteer angel to the police department. And we would literally get on the phone with them and access treatment for them right from the lobby of the police department. Unfortunately, during COVID, police departments closed their lobbies. So we ended up converting that into a call center where someone, we posted on the police department our call center number. We went from fielding 700 calls last year at this time to over 5,000 calls a month that are coming in for that program.
Are you getting people placed, I know as an emergency physician, I see people like in trouble, right, and have medical complications, and I can't always get them treatment, not right away.
We've really learned how to navigate the system.
Wow.
And if we can't get them, usually we're able to place them within a 2 to 3 day period of time max, most people the same day. But if we aren't able to do that, we at least get them connected to a peer recovery coach. We get their family connected to a family recovery coach. We try to find a safe environment for them to live in if they are unhoused. And then we continue to work on it until we find solutions. Most of the people that we have a harder time placing are people that are also suffering from a mental health issue, and it's severe to where there aren't facilities that will right away take them until they're stabilized. So we work with them to get them on medication, get them stabilized. But the bottom line is we don't drop the ball on them, whether they're difficult to place or not. We stay in contact with them. We give them a support system and we navigate the system until we can find a solution for them.
So in my experience, it's easier to get placement for people with an opiate use disorder. If they're addicted to fentanyl, get them Suboxone, get them treatment. But if they have a methamphetamine use disorder and they want help for meth, like I can get beds. We have beds for people with opiate use disorder, for alcohol use disorder. We don't have beds for people with stimulant use disorder. And it's a lot harder in San Diego and California, more than half of our deaths are from meth, more than fentanyl. And I'm wondering what your experience with that is.
Yeah, we don't have as big of a meth problem as California has. In some of our rural areas, we do. But we really, I think there's been a concerted effort in Michigan to really deal with the methamphetamine problem. So treatment facilities are willing to take individuals with them. But I agree with you, it's a little bit harder depending on which drug it is. But I think the important thing that we've done is that regardless of whether it's difficult or not, we stay the course with you because without help, you're never getting into treatment. So we stay the course with you until we find a solution for you. And that might be intensive outpatient with medication. We look for the solution that best fits your needs. And we're usually pretty successful with doing that.
And with your program, is it the individual who they actually want to? So there is an incentive there, right?
Yes and no. We also do a program called our Quick Response Team, where within 72 hours of a non-fatal overdose, or a lot of police departments are just adding people. Like they may go to a house for a domestic violence call. So there really are no drug charges that are being brought, but they suspect that there's a drug issue going on. They will put them on our quick response team list. They're really proactive in trying to identify people in the community that are suffering from everything from alcohol use disorder to methamphetamine.
What about cannabis? We see every day cannabis and psychosis, suicidality, other problems that...
We deal with it all. Any substance, we deal with any substance use disorder. Whether it's alcohol or any other substance that you're using, we will refer out for like gambling and sex disorders that are addictions as well. But we only deal with substance use disorder, but we deal with our share of also cannabis use disorders.
And do parents reach out to you too, or does an individual want help?
Both. We get a lot of families because we do a lot of family programming. We have a 12-step educational program. It's not, well, it is a support group because there are other parents there and it's led by someone who's been through this themselves. And so, but we train families, family coaches to be the leads for our Stronger Together program. And it's a 12-step educational program of what you should know if you are trying to help a loved one through addiction. You know, so we really try to educate our parents.
Is it kind of like Al-Anon or NARA?
No, not at all. There's crosstalk that can happen, and there's a more of an educational component where we really try, like so many parents are angry at their kids because they're using drugs. They don't understand they're suffering from a disease. And so we really try to educate them on what is this disease? What is it doing to your child? How can you best approach it? We teach them that lecturing and yelling and screaming isn't going to get the results that you want. Positive things that you can do, how to communicate, motivational interviewing with your child, how to talk appropriately to them.
Give us an example.
Okay, well, I'll give you an example of my child. When I was doing this, I say I almost loved her to death because I really didn't understand how to help someone with an addiction. You would think with all my years as a prosecutor, I ran our drug unit, and as a judge, I would have known that. But like I said, I really was just never educated about addiction, but I did a lot of reading and everything. But I find myself saying to her all the time, why are you doing this to me? You and I were so close. Can't you see you're killing me? Well, that just piled on more shame, made her feel worse about herself. And it truly made her want to go out and use again. You know, so we really try to help them understand to talk recovery language, that I love you and I'm here to support you. Let me help you get into recovery. I learned a lot of that actually out in California. She was in a treatment facility in California, and they would help us do recovery language with our children. And it was really amazing. It's like you don't buy into anything that's not recovery oriented. And so I would never, ever would have abandoned my daughter or not had conversation with her. But I really drew boundaries of what I was willing to accept and what I wasn't willing to accept, and always letting her know there that I was there to support her recovery when she was making those choices. And to be honest with you, when I started doing that was when she really decided that, you know, it wasn't as easy to use anymore because I wasn't buying into it. I couldn't be manipulated any longer. So we talk a lot about manipulation, that kind of thing. It's an online program. I would really suggest that you take a look at it.
Tell our audience, what is that program?
It's called Stronger Together. And we have people from all over the United States that join that program.
All right. So you will give me the link and I'll put that. Give me the link and I'll add that to the show notes.
Yeah. You can just go to faceaddictionnow.org and look for Stronger Together under our menu and click on it. And it'll give you all the times that a Stronger Together is offered. And I would invite anybody to check it out.
Yeah, that sounds great. Let's tell us about Face Addiction Now. You've been talking about that and all these great programs. What is your overall goal, or what is your outreach mission?
I would say that our overreaching macro look at this is that we look to change systems. Like we don't want to just help individuals get into treatment. We want to change the community that they're living in as well. So we do a lot around prevention and stigma, educating about stigma and about addiction itself. To really change systems and how they relate to this. Our police program is a perfect example of that, is that we're really changing a culture from arrest them and throw away the key to providing help and support and helping people flourish, which also makes our society a safer place to live in. And so we really focus on a lot of change within the system. We do a lot of work. We work with 23 hospital systems in the state of Michigan. And the same thing is true. When we first started our Hope Not Handcuff program, might interest you to know that we did a survey from people that were in recovery, and we asked them, if you were going to walk in and ask for help, would you be more comfortable walking into a hospital and asking for help or walking into a police department? 100% said police departments, which was mind-boggling to me. But I will tell you from the experiences I had with my daughter in hospitals, when I think back on it, I probably would have chosen police departments too. I have never felt so insignificant and unhelpable as when I went into a hospital setting with my daughter to ask for help. I think we're changing that culture.
Yeah, and we're getting better. But I remember those days. It's like, wait a second, I got CPR and a heart attack and a trauma and I have this. Like, you know, the priorities are different. And you've been in the emergency room and you've gone into a court that the emergency department is way more chaotic.
Yes, it's chaotic.
Very chaotic.
And nobody is going to listen to you. You know, at least when you're in front of a judge, that judge has their attention on you for a moment.
And also, we're helpless as medical professionals. We don't know these resources.
Right.
So you're asking me to help you without tools. If I have that's the reason things are changing in medicine is because we are getting the education. Right. We are getting the tools, right? Yeah. We want to, I mean, our profession is to help people. We love people. We want to help people. But you're asking me to solve a problem I don't know how. So
Right. And I think that there's a lot of that stigma is with doctors as well. Like, it amazes me, the same doctor that wrote prescriptions that got people addicted to opioids and has them now reeling with whatever their addiction may be, if it's not opioid related, will say things like, I don't want those people in my office. You know, I mean, it's just those people are the people that you helped when they were healthy. And now they're sick because of some of your behaviors and you need to.
It's interesting. I used to write like scripting for physicians of how to say, because it is a lot easier to, here's your 30 pills. I'm done with you. That's a lot faster. And it's a lot harder and takes more work to say no.
Yes.
And you say no out of love, like out of, you know, because you care, and it takes more time to say no. But we had like how to say no nicely scripting for the medical community.
Yeah, I want to make it clear, I'm not anti-medicine at all. The same doctor that wrote scripts for my daughter, he and I are very close friends now. I agree with you that I think it's a lack of education and resources. And I think hospitals and doctors are doing a much better job now of partnering with community resources like
ours. Because we don't have those
things. Deal with this issue. Yeah, in an emergency room, you're stabilizing and releasing. You do that with all diseases. The difference is that with other diseases, you have a whole list of things that you can recommend.
Right. We have tools and we have referrals, right? Yeah. You break your arm, I can set it and I can refer you to an orthopedic doctor.
Right.
With here, and now it's improving, but I'd be like, I don't know where to send you. Right. I don't need to hospitalize you. I don't have medications to give you. Like, what am I supposed to do? I don't know.
Well, and when you call an orthopedic, they're going to get you in a couple of days and see you. If you just give somebody a number and say, call this treatment facility, they're on a long waiting list. And by then they're out using again. Yeah. And so that's where we come in, is the hospitals call us. We immediately, within a 20-minute period of time, get a peer recovery coach to call that individual. We start looking for whatever treatment is available for that individual. We get them connected to resources immediately. And the hospitals are seeing a great return on that because it's not.
Oh, yeah. They need to thank you. They need to pay you. Do they pay you?
No. No. We're totally grant funded.
You're saving them so much
money. Yeah. We just got one of our big grants that's helping us do this cut. It got cut in the whole NIH sweep that just took place. So we're appealing it. We're hoping that we're going to get this administration to take a second look at it because
you're saving them a lot of money.
We truly are.
A lot of money and helping people. It's not just, it's effective. Wow. So good luck with that. I hope that works out.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Stigma. We just talk about stigma. And I like to bring that up because sometimes stigma, say we don't want stigma, and some people take that as like there's no stigma for drug use, like I could use drugs if I want to, and I like to differentiate, and I don't know if you agree, but we don't want stigma on the individual. They need compassionate care, but we do want stigma on the drug. I don't want you using heroin and fentanyl. I don't want
absolutely
like that's not good for you, that's not healthy for you,
right? Yeah, it's like so, a you want drugs to be looked at like a rattlesnake bite. You know, you don't want to walk up to a rattlesnake and let it bite. You don't want to do the same thing with drugs and the drugs that are on the market
right now. But there are some, you know, and in the whole new harm reduction, and we don't have a definition for harm reduction, and that's a problem. But there are some on an extreme who say, allow drug use. But meet you where you are. You want to use drugs, we're going to let you use drugs, like, and not encourage you not to do that. And I think that the stigma on that drug use is a problem. We don't want stigma on the drug user, but the drug itself should be
stigma. Yeah, but I agree that, that we may differ on this a little bit, actually, because I was really opposed to a lot of harm reduction modalities until I really dove into it and educated myself. But people can't just turn off drug use. You know, they really can't. Mm-hmm. If we can prevent infectious diseases and treat them compassionately while they're using drugs, the goal is always to get them off.
Oh, yeah. So that is science-based. Needle exchange is science-based. Yes. We have less agent HIV.
Okay, I didn't know if that's where you were going with that.
But my problem is there's no definition. That was always part of treatment, you know?
Right.
Now harm reduction, the definition of harm reduction is defined differently for different audiences. Right. And some people have taken it to social justice, allowing drugs to, we want to prevent infectious disease. We want to help you where you are until you're ready to stop.
Absolutely.
We understand that this is a chronic relapsing disease.
Yeah, we do harm reduction across all of our programs, full out harm reduction. We don't have safe use sites or anything like that in Michigan. But we do needle exchange. And I will tell you, I was educating yourself is where it's at, because I was against that when I first heard about it. When my team came to me and said, we want to do this, I was like, oh, I'm not sure about this.
No. Needle exchange is evidence-based as far as it's healthier for the people who, to prevent HIV and hepatitis B and... And if you use that in a way like, we care about you and maybe now you'll agree to go to treatment.
Right. Well, the proof's in the pudding. People are five times more likely to enter treatment.
Yeah.
And we see that every day. We work with literally thousands of people that come through our harm reduction program that are pre-contemplative. They haven't really started thinking about sobriety yet. But as they're working, the people that work in those programs are people with long-term recovery. And they start having conversations. And I would say that almost across the board, they eventually get to the point where they're like, you know what, you did this, maybe I can too. And they enter into treatment. So it's been a remarkable program. There was one young man that came through our harm reduction program. He was actually in my drug court and went missing in action. I mean, he came a couple of times and he just never came back and had a very long history of drug use. He also had some learning disabilities, which made it really difficult sometimes to deal with him. And he came to our harm reduction site. We have a medical team that works on our harm reduction site. We work with medical students and doctors and provide wound care and prescribe antibiotics if there's infections, that kind of thing, and really try to deal with that whole person model while we're out there. And this young man came and he was in really bad shape. He was running very high fever and he had been injecting into his neck and had gotten an abscess and had surgery on it. And the surgery site got infected. So he had a spot about the size of a tennis ball on the back of his neck that was infected. And his shirt was stuck to his back. And we didn't have a doctor at our site that day, but our team knew enough to call him and say, we've got this kid. And he said, I don't want to go to a hospital. They treat me awful when I'm there. All they're going to do is dress this and send me on my way. And I'm going to be sick again. I want you guys to help me. You know, you give me the antibiotics. So we called our doctor. He actually got in the car and drove to our site when we explained what was going on. He convinced the kid that when he got to the hospital that he would take care of him and that he would not let anybody mistreat him or talk badly to him.
That's good.
Yeah. So he got,
because if you're having a fever and you're that sick, you really do belong in a hospital.
Yeah. He was dying. I mean, there is no question. This young man was dying. So once again, to make a very long story short, the doctor rode with him in the ambulance, got him to the hospital, got him straightened up, got him an appointment to his clinic to continue to see him on a regular basis. We provided the transportation to get him back and forth to his appointments because he didn't have a way to get there. He got this place on his neck healed up, got himself healthy. Very shortly after that, got into recovery and is celebrating 2.5 years of recovery now. He was a kid that had been through the system. I can't even tell you how many times. And nobody intervened and no one was able to reach him. And it was that compassionate care at that harm reduction site that led him to long-term recovery. He's employed for the first time in his life. He's a productive member of society again. I could share hundreds of stories like that. Yeah. Recovery works when you have compassionate people delivering it. And they actually care about what happens to you, you know, which is what our group is all about.
Yeah, that is connection. And, you know, going back to your daughter, that's what finally worked with her, right? You said that she went into several different treatments, used a lot of money, but she finally made a personal connection, a human connection. And that's what.
Right. Absolutely.
That's what led her.
Yes.
That is beautiful. Final words of wisdom, advice to the administration, requests.
Yeah, don't throw out the baby with the bad laundry.
Save your program.
Know? Yeah, yeah. So that would be part of it. But the other part of it is that this is a treatable disease. Let's just really work together to put all of the resources into it that we need to really make true changes during the next 4 years of this administration, to really do things and work together as communities and the administration to get this job done. I mean, I love all of the policies with the border and stopping fentanyl from coming over, but we also have lots and lots of people that are already in the United States suffering. We need to make sure that we're providing ongoing help for them and really put the resources behind this to make a true difference in the lives of the people that live here and call themselves Americans.
Beautiful. And as a matter of fact, with if we're going to be successful at choking the supply, we have to learn historically from the opioid prescription epidemic. There is a period of time when you cut off that supply that people are desperate.
Yes.
And go to desperate needs. And we need to sound like you are prepared to deal with that gap. But we need, you know, all of America to be prepared.
Yeah.
Because we did have people who suffered unnecessarily when we stopped the opioid prescriptions. We weren't giving like 300 prescriptions per that.
Right.
Know, there was a gap of people who were vulnerable and got worse after that.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't happen this time.
Yeah, that literally is what our organization was founded on, was filling the gaps in a very broken system of care for individuals. And, you know, for every gap we fill, we find three more that need to be filled. And so we just continue to be that person that submits things together for individuals and make sure that there is a continuum of care. And I think that would be the bottom line, Renette, is that there needs to be a continuum of care for people that have this disease, just like there is for every other disease. And when we provide that long-term continuum of care, we really start to see incredibly positive results in long-term sobriety.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Judge Linda Davis, thank you so much for this conversation, for your inspiration and your work with Face Addiction Now and for the people of Michigan.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure being with you, and thank you for your patience in getting me on the show.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.